Well, good morning, Ocean View.
Good morning.
So I get to preach this morning. My name's Dwight Geiger, as you can see up there, and I haven't had a chance to preach here for a long time. Scott and Raina are visiting their new granddaughter. This is the first time Raina gets to actually hold her this weekend, and so she was very excited. So we're very excited for them as well. Now, I've been around here for a while. I'm a retired pastor. I do appreciate preaching occasionally. However, what I do realize is where it used to take me 3 days to write a sermon, it's more like 3 weeks. I got distracted very easily. Right now, I'm working. God has actually given me the opportunity to be a carpenter. So I've been a carpenter at Kwanos the last number of years, and we're working on redoing a whole bunch of cabins, building 4 new cabins, all kinds of stuff going on there. The other thing I had to do to introduce myself this morning is to apologize for my tie. I'm actually wearing a tie. I know we don't do that out west, but this is my only chance to wear my tie. I got it from Campbell River Church. They gave it to me, and it's kind of a First Nations one. It's really kind of cool. I don't get a chance to wear it, so I get to wear it. Advent is coming. I have 4 Advent ties, so I wear those as well. Now, Pastor Scott gave me Mark 12 to work on, and I've opted to give you my 2 cents worth. Now, that expression we use occasionally when we're giving one's opinion, sometimes it belittles the opinion to follow, suggesting that its value is only like 2 cents worth, a very small amount. Now, the user of the phrase showing politeness and humility hopes to lessen the impact of a possible contentious statement. For instance, if I may put my 2 cents in, that hat doesn't do you any favors. It's a polite way of saying that hat's ugly. Now, the expression can also be used to preface opinions. Well, my 2 cents is that you should sell your stock now. But that's just my 2 cents. So here's my 2 cents worth. Now, that question is, did that expression come from our passage this morning about the widow with the 2 coins? And there's divided opinions on that. If you look it up on the internet, where no one's really sure, but it seems to possibly have some influence in England in the late 1800s, and that's kind of where it came in. So we have Grandpa's basement here first. We got to kind of do that. Everybody asks what's coming in Grandpa's basement. Everybody, and who recognizes this? Yeah, you got to be old. It was the orange boxes from the Japanese oranges came in. About November, the ship would come in. It would come on the news, the ship's in, and little cardboard boxes. My dad would save them because we would use them for all kinds of things. And so I had 2 of them from my dad. The other one is, you may not have seen one of these. I was looking through Dad's boxes the other day. Who knows what they are? No. Shin plaster. Canadian. Oh, I forgot. I'm in charge. I got to remember that, though. Shin plaster. That's called a shin plaster. Now, the word shin plaster actually comes from the Americans. During the Civil War, the soldiers would actually use worthless money or low-end money and put it into their boots on their shins so it didn't hurt. Plaster is another name for bandage, so a shin bandage, shin plaster. This was a Canadian shin plaster. There, you can see how, okay, in comparison to a... Okay, how about this one? You can't see this one. I didn't do one of this. This is a King George VI. Not King Charles, King George. That's the normal size, okay, and that's the shin plaster. Worth 25 cents. And they kind of came in. Yeah, this one, the Canada minted them in... March 1870 to July 2nd, 1923. This is in 1923. What was happening is money was devaluing or was appreciating, not appreciating as fast as the coins. So you would have quarters. They're made out of silver, right? They were worth more than 25 cents. So tons of American money was coming into Canada, and we were melting it down and selling it as silver, and all of a sudden there weren't any quarters around to pay for milk and all those little bits and pieces, and so banks started issuing paper money, and this is the one of the shin plasters back in the 1920s to fill that gap. What I want to talk about is worthless money. It's like our story this morning. It's a mild Sabbath morning in the Palestinian city of Jerusalem. The sun hasn't yet risen to its full strength. People are already lined up all the way down the dusty road which leads to the Holy Temple. Smoke is in the air because of the animals that have already been sacrificed and burned on the altar. It smells like a huge barbecue. In that slow-moving line, there are rich and poor alike, carrying with them the offerings that they are to present to the Lord God Jehovah. At the top of the mountain, the line leads through the court of the Gentiles into the court of women. It's the last section before the court of Israel, where men of Israel in good standing would gather to observe the priests offering the sacrifices. Now, the court of women was as far as a woman could go. And in it, Maimonides, who was one of the most prolific and influential Torah scholars of the Middle Ages, Maimonides tells us that in the court of women, there were always 13 collection boxes available to the public in the Holy Temple. Each box was in the shape of a horn to prevent thieves from reaching inside and taking money. So the money would go in, but you couldn't get it out. The coins would make a constant clanging sound and noise as their money is cast in. They were out of metal, and so you would hear that clinging, clinging, clinging as people were giving their offerings. Each of those 13 collection boxes would be designated for different things, so it depended what you were giving to would go into those things. I'm sure the financial people would have just go crazy with all the divisions and all these budget things that they were having to deal with. Now, most of the people shuffling along quickly make their donations and move on. But Rabbi Yeshua, who had already presented his offering, he sits over in the corner with his Talmudim, Jesus, with his disciples. They're watching the people put their money into the collection boxes. Also in the room supervising the money boxes are several priests. And as the wealthy citizens passed by, made loud clanging noises with their many coins, they seemed to draw favored glances as people going, "Wow, that's really cool." Many seemed quite impressed at the generosity of those who cast lots of big, heavy coins into the boxes. It's not surprising that no one pays particular attention to one lady who enters the room. She's a widow, and only one person sees her, and that's the one who sees all. She stops at the collection terminal. She reaches into a tiny bag and carefully draws out two rather insignificant bronze coins. She tosses both of these lightweight coins into the big metal box. Their faint clink is drowned out by the heavy clanking of more substantial coins made by the wealthy patrons. No one notices her. After all, what difference would her two tiny tokens make? But Jesus is impressed. He's so impressed that he singles this woman out to his apprentices. He confesses that her offerings are greater than those made by men of wealth and prestige. Peter is so impressed with this event that he tells it to his secretary, Mark, who permanently records it in our passage this morning. And later, Dr. Luke copies it down in his gospel account, almost word for word, to ensure that this woman's place is in history. The widow who sacrificed all she had. Let me read it again as we kind of come in and try to figure out what's going on here. Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts. But a poor widow came and put in two very small copper, it actually was bronze, coins worth only a few cents. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They all gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in everything, all she had to live on." Now, after reading about this event, we might wonder, why was Jesus so impressed with the widow who put in her two coins? What was it that caused him to stop and single her out of the crowd? Why did he draw attention to her minute gift so publicly? For years, you've probably heard this story only in the context of giving. Statements have rained down about how the woman's sacrifice was so great, therefore we are all called to sacrifice. Notice this one, the widow's mite and the value of sacrificial offerings. Now, if you came expecting to hear a message on giving, I'm disappointing you. We're not going to talk about giving. This poor little woman gave all she had, while the wealthy gave a lot, but not everything. So who's going to empty their bank accounts so we can build onto our building and add an education wing? We need more parking. So who's going to sell their home and purchase the lot next door? You'll be blessed, just as this woman was blessed for all she giving all she had. Now, I've heard messages similar to that over the years, and no doubt you have as well. But as I looked at this passage, I was really bothered. And I'm questioning if these ideas were really what Jesus was actually talking about. In fact, this great temple, Herod's temple, that the woman was donating towards, had only a few years left, despite all its grandeur. Mark continues this story in the next chapter, which we didn't read, but let me read you the first few verses of the next chapter. As Jesus was leaving the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what massive stones." And they were big. Even today, there are a few of the stones on the foundation of Herod's stones. They are like 100 tons. They're huge. "What magnificent buildings." "You see all these great buildings," replied Jesus. "Not one stone will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." Herod's temple was an 80-year building project. At this point in Jesus' story that we're reading about, it's around 30 AD. It was about half finished. It was finally finished 30 years later in 60 AD. And 10 years later, it was completely destroyed. It was completely destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD by an army so infuriated that they tore down every stone of the temple. Today, you can go to the Temple Mount and you'll see these stones all laying all around, but there isn't anything on top of the Temple Mount that was part of the temple. It was completely destroyed. Which leads me to think, I don't think fundraising was on Jesus' mind when he pointed out this woman to his disciples. Encourage people to give like this woman. It doesn't say that. Don't neglect the context of this story. Look at what's going before and after. It happens in both Mark and Luke. I checked it, and Luke's almost identical to what Mark is saying. Jesus had just finished commenting on the teachers of the law, the religious elite, the lawyers, the professors, the judges of Israel. They were the interpreters of the Torah, of the law. What did he say about them? "Watch out for the teachers of the law. They like to walk around in flowing robes and be greeted with respect in the marketplaces. They like to have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses for a show, make lengthy prayers. These men will be punished most severely." Is it possible that this is not a story that applauds the widow's dedication to giving, but critiques how the widow has been exploited? This interpretation doesn't diminish her devotion. It dignifies her suffering. It shifts the spotlight from her coins to the system that demanded them. Jesus condemns a religious elite who devour widows' houses. He watches a widow give everything she has, not some, not much, everything, all she had to live on. Jesus knew that. Maybe it's not praise, but heartbreak. Remember, this is the Jesus who flips tables, who weeps over Jerusalem, who calls out injustice cloaked in religious robes. This Jesus sees a widow not as a sermon illustration, but as a beloved daughter crushed by the weight of institutional greed. How many widows have been persuaded to give substantially more than they could afford, even today? TV evangelists, church fundraising campaigns, encouraged to pattern their life after this widow in Mark 12. Devouring widows' houses is definitely not in Jesus' plan. So as I study this passage, I notice that nowhere does Jesus actually commend this lady. He doesn't say she's greatly blessed. She doesn't say great is her reward in heaven. No, he just was working the percentages. Those rich fellas, they gave 10%. This lady gave 100%. In God's economy, she put more in the treasury than all the others. In fact, it was all she had to live on. So why does he make an issue out of this woman who put in all she had to live on? And being a bit of a rather curious sort, I asked, how much was it anyway? It's commonly known as the widow's mite. The reason they is mite is the King James Version used mite because that was the smallest coin in England in the 17th century. You had your mite and your farthing and pounds. Two mites. 2 cents, it says. Worth only a few cents. Her 2 cents worth. Let me show you what it is. Okay. There's your Canadian penny for you guys who've never seen one before in your life. Did you realize, I don't know if it's true, but it came out on Facebook, the United States printed their last penny on Thursday. The United States is phasing out the penny as well. There's the mite. I can't even hold it. That's a mite. 1 centimeter, 1/2 inch. Penny is 2 centimeters, about 3/4 inch. So that's 2 mites that she had. And it was made out of copper. So literally, in the Greek, it says a lepton. Now the word lepton is Greek for small. It was minted by Alexander Janus, who was king of Judea in about 100 years before Jesus. It was stamped out of bronze. It was still in circulation at the time of Jesus, probably lots of them around. Mark specifically says it was 2 lepta, and at that time they were worth a quadrantis, which is Greek for the Latin quadrans, the smallest Roman coin. So a quadrans is a quarter, and I'm sorry, it is a quarter of an ass. A-S. I looked it up. I said, is there any other way to say this? No, it is an ass. So a quarter of an ass. So let's figure out how much this is really worth. BC minimum wage as of June 1st, 2025 is $17.85. A denarius was a day's wage in Jesus' day. It was a silver coin. So let's say that silver coin is worth $142.80 in our day and age. An ass is 1/16th of a denarius, equal to $8.93. Now, it used to be 1/10th. But because of the Punic Wars in 140 BC, they devalued the ass so they could finance the Punic Wars, just so you know. The plural of ass is Assyrian, so let's call it the Assyrian, okay? So, a quadrans was 1/4 of an ass. So, Mark tells us that a quadrans was equal to 2 lepta. So a quadrant is worth $2.23. A lepta would be worth $1.11. All in all, the lepton had the buying power of today's loonie. 1 lepton was worth 6 minutes of labor. It could buy entry into a Roman bath. So for your loonie, you can go down to your local swimming pool today. Let's update the language Anybody seen a King Charles coin yet? Well, a few of you have. We're out west. We get them way later than anybody else. So a poor widow came in and put in 2 loonies worth only a toonie. What can you buy with a toonie? As a kid, I would have thought I was lucky to have a toonie. And I looked at Walmart, and I could get a chocolate bar. One snack. So what would she have purchased for a toonie to live on? Well, I looked it up. You can get a 1 kilogram of flour for $2.37, or 1 kilogram of steel-cut oats for $2.77. So she could have got home and made pancakes, or bought enough for pancakes, or she could have made matzah, and she would have 1 kilogram of matzah. That is 1 kilogram of the typical bread that they would make. And that would last her until she could get some more money. So what is she going to do? She just gave all her money away. She gave it to God. Where does she go now? To the food bank? There isn't one. Begging on the street, most likely, or goes hungry until she's able to clean someone's house for a few more lepta. She made a sacrifice, and God noticed. She put in all she had to live on, even though it was a small amount, it was 100%. In the worship of the Old Testament, part of worship was sacrifice to God. It could be an animal or produce or grain, or it could be money, it could be coins. But it was a sacrifice. You gave up something to worship God. It cost something. Paul encourages believers in Romans chapter 12, verse 1. He says, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Living sacrifice is giving everything. Daily living lives that are given to God. This widow's actions are pointing in this direction. Now, her story is not dramatic, revolutionary, significant, or amazing. Hers is a story of a woman who no one notices, and worse, whom no one even cares to notice. In her world, she's just part of the landscape. She's just another blurry figure in the background of the photo on the third page of Section D in the local newspaper. Yet she's a faithful blur. She's the one who loves God. She doesn't care if she's noticed. She cares whether God is noticed. Jesus understood this type of life all too well. You know, we all know the glorious end of the glorious story of Jesus the Messiah. Yet we have let ourselves fall captive to the prevailing notion about how significant the ministry of Jesus was in his day. Because we've heard the biblical stories over and over again, we've exaggerated the actual size of Jesus' tiny ministry. There were crowds, but he was always trying to avoid the crowds. Jesus' ministry lasted a short 3 years. He really didn't do a whole lot in the context of news and events of the day. If you made a Reader's Digest version of his ministry, he hung around with a few guys. He healed a leper or two and a couple of lame folks and a blind guy. He made some wine, helped out 3 or 4 women. He raised 3 people from the dead, calmed down a crazy person or two, caused a scene in the temple, got himself publicly executed as a criminal, then disappeared. Just imagine what Jesus could have done if he'd lived and ministered for 30 or 40 years. Jesus showed up for a little while, did a few miracles, said some amazing words, and left. But those few small miracles, those incredible words, changed the world forever. It's the value of the tiny, the value of the seemingly insignificant efforts of our lives. J.R. Tolkien was a Christian writer, and he portrayed this in the stories of The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings. On your right is Bilbo Baggins. He's a hobbit, sometimes called a halfling. On the left is Gandalf the Grey. He's normal human size. Gandalf is a wizard, a wise man. There's a quote by Gandalf in the movie The Hobbit. Now, this quote is not written by J.R. Tolkien. I looked it up. It's not in The Hobbit at all. It's not in any of them. It was a quote written by Peter Jackson and the three other guys who actually were the writers of The Hobbit. But it does emulate the philosophy that Tolkien embedded into these stories, from The Hobbit to the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Here is Gandalf kind of wondering and expressing why he chose a hobbit to do the message.
Mithrandir, why the halfling?
I don't know. Saruman believes that it is only a great power that can hold evil in check. But that is not what I have found. I found it is the small things, everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keeps the darkness at bay. Simple acts of kindness and love. Why Bilbo Baggins? Perhaps it is because I'm afraid. But it gives me courage.
It is the small, everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keeps the darkness at bay. Small, simple acts of kindness and love. Perhaps Jesus was trying through our story this morning to get the point across of the power of goodness found in the tiny. Small acts of kindness and love. God has always chosen the tiny over the large. David over Goliath, Gideon and his 300 soldiers over the many thousands of Midianites, Elijah over the prophets of Baal, one sheep over the 99, Moses, a simple shepherd, challenged the most powerful man on earth, Mary, an unwed teenager who gracefully submitted to an unwanted pregnancy, Peter, a rough-hewn fisherman working his nets, was Jesus' choice to become a fisher of men and lead his church. Real spirituality is about doing the tiny work of God, little acts and small responses to God's urging in our lives. You know, it's easy for us to imagine that God is about the big stuff, the spectacular, the miraculous. We often conclude from the books, the sermons, the TV shows that unless God is doing some really big things around us and through us, we're not very spiritual. That the only way we become spiritual is for our lives to live large. That's just not reality. The widow at this temple at this time shows us the teaching of Jesus, proves it, and the life of Jesus magnifies it. The spiritual life is not necessarily a life of success. Spirituality is really a life of faithfulness. God does do big stuff every once in a while, but perhaps the primary work of God in our world is tiny. We're dazzled by the big things, but Jesus told parables of the lost sheep, the lost coin, the prodigal son, the mustard seed. He was saying that if your life is to live large, you must learn to live and revel in the tiny. Mike Iaconelli, where I was with Youth Specialties, when I was a youth pastor, we used to use all his books. He had all these books about games and doing stuff, but he actually wrote some actually serious stuff. One is called Messy Spirituality. In it, he says this: the real spiritual life is filled with little decisions, tiny steps toward God, tiny glimpses of his presence, little changes, tiny successes, an almost imperceptible movement in the right direction. Over a lifetime, the collective weight of those decisions, glimpses, and tiny steps is immense. Christianity shows itself most powerfully in the unnoticed life, in the invisible disciple, or the unrecognized saint. Our tiny choices and tiny movements toward God may not seem like much, and we may get very discouraged when nothing seems to be going on. But someday you and I will stand together in the great expanse called heaven. We will stand before the mighty God of the eternal. And on that day, I hit the wrong one. Try again. Nope. It disappeared. Okay, there. That's what I wanted you to see. A tapestry. On the outside, you see what? That crown. That's the crown you'll receive with Jesus. But on the back of that tapestry, what do you see? A whole bunch of tiny little things that don't seem to make any sense. It's a mess. Life is about the little touch, the tiny words of encouragement, the little acts that service and sacrifice, the faithfulness of thought and word and deed, that just showing up. If you find yourself unable to believe that God is best served by the tiny stuff of your life, you will experience more joy and assurance and peace than you can ever imagine, because living large spiritually is living small physically. Do you remember that quirky neighbor in Home Alone 1? He reminds me of Grandpa Hamer. You don't know Grandpa Hamer. I can't remember much about Grandpa Hamer. I asked my brother this morning, do you remember Grandpa Hamer? Of course, his memory's way better than mine. I don't know why. He's younger, that's why. He remembers Grandpa Hamer. He says, yeah, from the back, he looked just like our grandfather, Grandpa Pack. I don't remember what Grandpa Hamer looks like. He's just a blur, but every time I see this movie, I'm going, oh, that's Grandpa Hamer. Everyone called him Grandpa Hamer. He was a quiet, elderly man. He sat in the back corner pew on the left side of the church every Sunday. He didn't do anything great. Yet I remember him as a follower of Jesus. I don't know why I remember him all these years, 70 years. Maybe he gave me a candy, I don't know. But my mom spoke of him with respect, and I remember often on Sunday morning we come, she'd say, oh, let's go say hello to Grandpa Hamer. And we go say hello to Grandpa Hamer. I'm like 3 or 4, 5 years old. One Sunday, he wasn't there anymore. He passed away. Yet his name stuck in my mind for 70 years. Grandpa Hamer was a follower of Jesus. You know, I have seen many elderly folk who can't do much anymore. They're slowed down. They're weakened. They're in pain. Yet they faithfully turn up every week. They can barely even sing anymore. They don't even stand. They sit most of the time. Mrs. Jansen, Grandma Meggett, Bud Traver, Margaret Traver. They were my encouragers, my examples, faithfully bringing their 2 lepta of worship every Sunday. And now I am the elderly old man sitting in the back row of the church, encouraged by all the young people I see. High school students, Kaleo students, Cape and Ray students. And did you see the little ones this morning? Worship dance in the front rows? They were given it. Don't ever discourage them. Think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. Reflecting on biblical figures who played key roles in God's story, a few principles emerge that we can apply in our own lives. Number one, God uses those who are willing. You've heard the saying, God can't steer a parked car. We have to start our engines, give God access to us, and he will pass over the best and the brightest to the available and the obedient. Number two, God works in our weakness. We don't like feeling helpless, inadequate. But when we depend on him rather than ourselves, the Lord told Paul, my power is made perfect in weakness, and it's true of us as well. Number three, all of us have something God can use. Moses had a staff, David had a slingshot. There was a boy who had a simple lunch that somehow fed 5,000 people. The question isn't whether what we have is good enough for God. It's whether we will offer what we have for his service. God called each of us to join him in his kingdom mission. No credentials required. Inevitably, we'll face a Goliath or an impasse like the Red Sea. Sometimes we'll feel unequal to the task. But the good news is God's plan doesn't rely on our greatness, but rather on his. He fashioned us in our mother's wounds, placed us in the world for such a time as this. In discovering our purpose, we become the people God created us to be. We paused for a moment this past week to remember World War II and the other wars. Elmer Bendinger was a B-17 navigator during World War II, and he tells the story of a bombing run over Kassel, Germany, and the unexpected results of a direct hit on their gas tank. Here's his story from his book, The Fall of Fortresses, and I quote, "Our B-17, the Tondaleo, was barraged by flak from Nazi aircraft guns. That was typical. But on this particular occasion, our gas tanks were hit. Later, as I reflected on the miracle of a 20-millimeter shell piercing the fuel tank without touching off an explosion, our pilot, Bon Fox, told me it was more complicated than that. On the morning following the raid, Bon asked our crew chief for that shell as a souvenir of our unbelievable luck. The crew chief told Bon that in addition to that shell, another 11 were found in the gas tanks. 11 unexploded shells, where only one was sufficient to blast us out of the sky. It was as if the sea had parted for us, a near miracle, I thought. Even after 35 years, this awesome event leaves me shaken, especially after I heard the rest of the story from Bon. Bon was told that the shells were sent to the armorers to be defused. The armorers told him that intelligence had picked them up. They couldn't say why at the time, but Bon eventually sought out the answer. Apparently, when the armorers opened up each of those shells, they found no explosive charge. They were clean as a whistle and just as harmless, empty, but not all of them. One contained a carefully rolled piece of paper with a scrawled message in Czech. The intelligence people scoured our base for a man who could read Czech. Eventually, they found one to decipher the note. It was amazing. Translated, the note read, "This is all we can do for you now." Sounds like tiny stuff. Just a few bullets out of many millions and millions of bullets made during the war, but those particular bullets made the difference for the crew of one B-17 bomber. There's no end to the good that can come from tiny decisions, tiny actions, or even tiny words of encouragement. By doing the tiny stuff in the world, you will recognize the power of the ordinary, the significance of the insignificant, the eternal difference that ordinary, messy, unfinished, under construction people like you and me can make. Be happy with the ordinary and the tiny. Give your 2 lepta, your 2 cents worth. Would you join me in prayer? Heavenly Father, you are worthy to receive all the glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they were created and have their being. You created us in our tiny lives. Thank you that though we are tiny, we have a purpose and meaning. Thank you that our insignificant 2 lepta lives can live large in your kingdom. May your kingdom come and your will be done. Give us today our daily bread and help us to forgive. May we find opportunity this week for small acts of kindness and love that are done in your name in order to keep the darkness at bay. Amen.